The fundamental picture in your book is of a woman who's reached her mid-70s who's ready to bail out of the wellness cult, the mindset of our medical culture. At what point did you say, enough already? I don't want to know any more things about my body that only medical equipment can detect.
Well, I think it started a few decades ago. I'm 76 years old now. I think it started somewhere maybe in my 50s. I'm just very skeptical about, everything, but it's medical care especially. And when you get over 50, and certainly when you get over the age where you're getting Medicare, and they keep finding things to test about you. Screenings, exams, the reasons to come in to the doctor. Now, you could look at this rather cynically, because what else are they going to do with well people? And most of us, I would say, are well, like myself. You can't make money off of well people. You have to go looking for things about them that would warrant further investigations and further screenings and possibly some surgery and so on. Now, I'm not totally that cynical. I mean, I think most doctors want to do the best by their patients, and the best may mean the latest test. But I personally don't want to participate in this anymore. And I guess I started getting really uneasy about it when the primary care physician suggested that I have a bone density scan.
Right.
Why? Because I'm a woman over a certain age. And we should all have bone density scans. Well, I should have pressed harder on my questions. One, what are you likely to find? And two, what could you do about it if you do find it?
Right.
So, you know, those are the questions you have to first start with. Not that you're going to get a straight answer all the time. So I was doubtful, but I did it and found out that I had something called osteopenia. Which sounds pretty scary until you find that about half the women in this country over the age of 50 suffer from this terrible disease. Well, it's not a disease. It just means your bones are getting thinner because you're old. You're older. And so I don't think that should be called a disease. I think that should be called just a life phase for women. And the drug available at the time, well, it's probably the major drug still, is unfortunately, for in some cases, actually causes bone fractures. So I said, you know, this is not interesting news. I'm sorry I took the time for the scan, that was wasted. And as I went on for one after another of these things that were so important, I, you know, would do a little research on them and find out that they were very dubious, both in what they could find and whether anything could be done about it.
You come at it with a certain prejudice. It was sort of news to me, but the screening era, early detection, mammograms, prostate exams, this kind of thing, in fact, have not cut mortality, notably. But you also say we're, in general, overtreated, overmeasured, overdiagnosed, and yet a lot of people in this country are not. In our private system, God bless Medicare, a lot of people don't get enough of these, even the early detection, do they?
Oh, no, but a really basic kind of skewing in healthcare spending in this country is away from the young and toward the elderly. Once the elderly have Medicare, then they can be subjected to all kinds of screenings and tests. In the meantime, we have a society in which something as basic as maternal mortality is rising. You know, that was we always thought that was just going down. Because there isn't prenatal care for poor women, and especially poor black women. We have a system where we talk about an opioid crisis, but we really don't have treatment facilities or any way of helping so many young people who've had trouble with these things. So all the spending is skewed toward the older people. And that's kind of crazy.
What does your retirement from the system do for it?
Well, it frees up some time.
for you, know, you and I told, for the system.
When I first went to meet the person who is now my primary care physician, I said to her, I will come to you if I have a problem, but don't you go looking for problems, okay? That's a deal. So I don't, you know, she's not going to bother me about a mammogram. She's not going to bother me about a colonoscopy because I'm not interested. I don't do those things. And what I do instead is, well, work and enjoy people, friends and family, mm-hmm. and try to do something to make the world a slightly better place.
And you write very interesting books. There's a deeper idea that runs through many, many aspects of this book, that we are spooked in this culture by death, more than we used to be, more than we ought to be, more than most people in the world are, that our notion of wellness is a kind of illusion of the perfect body, but the underlying hope is that we're gonna beat the odds, we're gonna be Ray Kurzweil, we're gonna live forever, and that it's fundamentally crazy. Spell that out.
Yeah, no, I'm not really talking much about death itself and dying, but I have noticed that when I talk about this book with a lot of people, including good friends, as I say, oh, I don't talk about it. Well, look, you know, it's time we did talk about it. The prospect of dying and death is something we all have in common.
Yep.
And it intensifies as we get older. Why can't we talk about it? I mean, I just, you know, I just find that very distasteful. Like it's some secret that you just keep to yourself. And hoping, of course, that you'll outwit the odds by drinking enough kombucha.
Can you take apart the wellness thing, the imagery of tight butts on everybody running in clinging clothes? What's happening?
Well, one kind of explanation, which I think makes a lot of sense, is that there is not a lot that we can really control in our lives. You might lose your job at any moment, not you personally, Chris, but we know our jobs are not secure, those of us, you know, who work for corporations, for example. But, you know, there is a deep insecurity. If we lose our jobs, there is no welfare state to just fall back on. You know, Social Security is about it. And also we feel helpless when it comes to the politics of our country.
Right.
What can we do? So many things seem to have gone out of control. So we can go to the gym, and there, you know, though I have no leverage over, say, the president's next tweet or anything, I can do something to strengthen my quadriceps. I can control that. I can build my calves. I know these things that I would like to achieve in the gym, and I can do them. So, that you know, as we lost power in other parts of our lives, more public parts of our lives, we have retreated into this, whether it's fitness or self-care, that we can do just for ourselves and apparently sometimes be successful at. This is the one zone of our lives in which we can be in charge of our own bodies, of our weight, for example.
It's related to so many other things. I begin to wonder what went wrong in the mid-70s. So many of our economic, political, and you're saying social, medical hang-ups developed in the mid-70s. And it suddenly dawns on me, reading your book, you don't mention Bruce Springsteen, but I've been to his concerts since the late 70s, and they're full of guys who used to have more important jobs, machinists or factory workers, mm-hmm. or professional people. And there's Bruce, you know, buff then, buff now, defying what's happened somehow. You say the fitness culture began somewhere in the 70s. What did it? I think deindustrialization had something to do with it.
Well, deindustrialization had a lot to do with, I mean, that just pulled the rug out from the blue-collar American working class. But the other thing, there was the oil crisis in the 70s, a sense that growth was not limitless, a sense that we would have to face certain kinds of scarcity in our lives. It was, I think, more of a cultural upheaval than we realized at the time. There's also feminism. That fit into this because for women, it was a big deal to start building our muscles. All we'd been told to do before that was to make ourselves thin and small and tiny. And now suddenly it was okay to build muscles.
You're ambiguous, Barbara, because you're on both sides of the fitness, take control, assert yourself. But you also see something deeply deluded about it.
Well, the delusion is that you can prolong your life indefinitely by focusing on that, you know, just prolonging your life, doing all the right things, eating the right things, and so on. You can't. It's that is a delusion. And so we have to also ask ourselves, how do we want to live our lives? Do I want to live more, you know, any more of my life in a windowless doctor's waiting room? No. Done with that. Over. Finished. Because as you get older, time gets more precious. And if you told me that if I go on the treadmill for 30 minutes a day, I'll get to live 3 more minutes, I'm sorry. There are other things maybe that I'd want to do more than being on the treadmill. I am not really interested in endlessly prolonging my life. I'm interested in getting things done, you know, hanging out, whatever.
You're holding Silicon Valley accountable here in a lot of this book, Barbara, and I wonder just what the charge is. Take it apart.
The interesting thing to me about Silicon Valley is the arrogance and narcissism of its prevailing leaders. We have a pretty high concentration of billionaires who come out of Silicon Valley and who refuse to die. I'm not saying they have to die right now, but who have it in their heads that they can prolong their lives indefinitely if they can just hack their bodies.
Ray Kurzweil is the poster child by his own admission, by his own announcement.
Oh, yeah.
But Peter Thiel may be not far behind.
No, he's one of the immortalists. They don't intend to die. After all, if you're one of the richest people and notoriously the smartest people in the world, why should you die? It's insulting to even suggest such a thing. So, yeah, that's I would say, pretty pathological.
But what is it that's rubbing off on all of us in that illusion?
Well, what we are told in sort of the various self-help books, and especially in the self-help books now on the theme of, quote, successful aging. My favorite of these books is one called Younger Next Year, a very optimistic idea. And, you know, it just says, whatever you've been doing up to now, you can't do it. You've got to spend 6 days a week or 6 sessions a week at the gym. No excuses, no delays. And then similarly with food and everything, you have to be equally draconian about when you're older.
Isn't it clear that there's something in this self culture, the Facebook culture, the branding of self, that makes it harder to die, even to imagine dying?
Exactly. In order to face death, you have to be able to face the dissolution of yourself. The self will come to an end. I have to be able to imagine that there will be a world without me in it. And you know what? That's fine with me. The world is going to get along fine without me.
You have a wonderful moment late in the book, Barbara, where you speak of exactly that notion. The revolutionary, you say, lives and dies for her people, secure in her belief that someone else will pick up the banner when she falls. To the true believer, applies to religious believers too, individual death is incidental. You speak of that as a new idea, but it's really a very old idea.
No, it's an old idea. The feeling that you are part of a stream, a river that is moving forward. You are just one little blip in it.
Well, maybe an important blip in it.
Well, I don't care. And it's not going to matter. To focus on being important, being famous, is to miss the point, I think.
And to fix on death as the end misses the point, too. You remind me of the epigraph in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov quotes actually the Gospel of John. And the line is immensely powerful to me. It's basically that except the corn of wheat fall to the ground and die, it dies alone and forever. But if it does fall to the ground, it begets eternal life, more and more life. That's a very old Christian, but ultimately very broad idea and a beautiful one.
Right, but I'm thinking, Dostoevsky was quite a mystical fellow. Of the sense, for example, that there is a movement for social justice.
Yes.
It's been going on for centuries, and that it will go on in some ways that I might not even recognize without me. And that's good. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
We don't come from dust and return to dust. We come from life in our parents, and we go on to life, even if birds peck away at our bodies, Our life is on the wing within hours after we die.
That's a nice way to put it.
Well, it's sort of what
I like that
Brecht was saying in his reflection that you quote on the blackbird.
Well, he wasn't talking about being eaten by blackbirds, but he was thinking that just their song will continue. He was about to die. He was days away from death when he wrote that poem, which I found, thanks to a book by David Reif about his mother, Susan Sontag.
Who struggled with death to the very last stroke.
Oh, she absolutely would not give up. And went through some horrendous treatments when her cancer returned when she was about 70. Her breast cancer she had earlier. And she would just go for whatever crazy thing the doctors had on offer, she would want to try it. Now, I was her son to say, this is crazy, Mom. Why don't you just relax and listen to your favorite music or something for a while? But no, she was tormented by these extreme treatments. And I think that made a big impression on her son. I know it did, because his book about her death is very much about that theme. And he remarks, David Reif remarks about his mother, Susan Sontag, that she had even written in her journal, the only way to face death is to, I'm paraphrasing, get over oneself, get past the I. This is what she could not do herself. What I kept reading over and over from people who do occasionally, philosophers and physicians often, write about the prospect of dying, is that they cannot imagine a world without themselves in it. Well, try, I would say. Give it a try. To me, it goes on just fine. The sun rises and sets in glory. The birds flock that I can see outside my window. All this will continue. And that's beautiful to me.
And the graveyard is chock full of absolutely indispensable people. Michael Pollan, so-called food writer, is at work on a wonderful book about psilocybin as a treatment especially for older people, anxiety and depression. And the way psilocybin works in these experiments is, in some fashion, to break the grip of ego on all of us.
What fascinated me is that there is a biological basis to that. When they look at the effect of psilocybin on the human brain, the part that it is suppressing, where it is suppressing brain activity, is that center of self.
Yes.
Where you see, this is me, here's the boundary, that is not me, and all kinds of things that are important, say, for navigating your way around the world. But when they can be let go, when vigilance really drops with the drug, so does the terrible anxiety about dying. And these are not only experiments with older people, but typically with people who have terminal cancer have been studied. People who could be in their 40s or 50s even.
What's the moral for everybody that's in danger of being full of themselves?
Get over yourself. Let yourself be drawn out of your skull into the things that are going on around you. And, you know, into the even things that are happening in the natural world, things that are happening just in the change in the light as the sun gets lower, all of these things, and not just me, me, me. Do you think I should become a guru?
Yeah, you are a guru. You're my guru. So much of this book is addressed directly or indirectly to Silicon Valley. The illusions of wellness, delusions of control, a fear of death, which comes to every one of us. Sum it up. What are we trying to tell them?
Well, I think they've really drifted off away from terrestrial territory in many ways. When they start thinking more and more about creating colonies for rich people to live in space. That's like bye-bye people, bye-bye Earth. When they say, I'm going to design a way that I can live forever and it will only take a few of my billions to pay for, then again they're saying bye, goodbye, and developing colonies out at sea. Seasteading, I think, is a Silicon Valley word for that. Now, I mean, I see some kind of adventure in all of these things. I think it's interesting to think of new ways to survive. But these are all very much limited by social class and especially limited to a tiny percent of the top 1%. There's very few people in Silicon Valley who Bill Gates would be an exception, who are willing to think of large numbers of people and saving them and not just this teeny tiny elite.
Barbara Ehrenreich, keep doing exactly what you're doing, and thank you very, very much for this conversation.
Oh, you know, it's my pleasure.